Hi, everyone. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Lily. So I want to tell you the other part of the story about Dick. So I'm at this conference in Florida, and it's their 50th state anniversary. Now, when I first got sober, I couldn't go to meetings on Sunday morning, and so I used to listen to cassette tapes. And I used to listen to these giants in AA. That's what I thought. You know, I'm new, and holy cow, these guys are out there, and I didn't know they had a name for them. I just thought, they're the gurus of AA. So I used to listen to Dick Anderson and Keith Lewis and Sandy Beach. So now, Liz Bailey, and now I'm in the front row with the speakers, and there's Liz Bailey and Keith Lewis, Dick Anderson, Sandy Beach, and I'm like, what am I doing here? You know, how did a girl from Windham, Maine fall off on a bar stool and end up here? But my first impression of Dick was he was a little bit angry. And I thought, oh, no, because he's one of those gurus, and he's not having a good time right now. And so I immediately go back to my room, and I call my sponsor, Jane. You know those people I always told you about? Well, this guy, Dick, I'm telling you right now, he's not happy. He's kind of angry, and I don't know what to do. And she said, yes, you do. She said, you go and sit down and talk with him and ask him what the matter is. I'm like, you've got to be kidding. Why did I call her, you know? So now I'm going to confront him, like, why are you angry? And I'm thinking, oh, Jesus, get me out of this one, you know. Please, God, get me out of this. So at the same time at this conference, there was a fellow that had been in and out of AA, and he had quite some time in AA, and then he went out. And now he's back, and he's at this conference, and he's only got like a couple of days. But the wisdom of the people in AA, they gave him a job to do, and his job was to go to all the speakers before the meeting and see if they needed anything. And Dick is sitting right next to me, and he gets to Dick before me, and he goes, do you need anything? And Dick says, yes, I need water and something sweet. I really have a headache, and it sort of makes me out of sorts. And I went, thank you, Jesus. Because then I didn't have to confront him. I mean, there was a reason why he was a little out of sorts. Anyway, my sobriety date is November the 8th, 1989. I'm a grateful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not have a desire to quit drinking when I got here. There were a lot of people in my life that had a desire for me to quit drinking. I just wasn't one of them. And I wasn't happy when I came. You probably heard me the other night. I talked about coming to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous looked a little bit like this. It was November the 15th, and it was really, really cold out. And we went to this church, and you had to walk down six steps into the basement of the church. And there was this old guy standing outside the meeting, and he was shaking. And he was kind of short, and he was shaking like a leaf. And he saw me, and he said, welcome. You're amongst your own kind. And I looked at him, and I thought, I don't think so, bucko. You know, and I'm thinking to myself, somebody ought to get this guy a drink, because he was shaking. I didn't know that he was cold. I mean, I just thought anybody that shook like that was like me, and they needed a drink, you know. And so anyway, so I go in the meeting, and it's Alcoholics Anonymous. And I figured out right off the bat why you called it Alcoholics Anonymous. Because, you see, half of the room was non-smoking, and the other half was smoking. But when you walked into this room, it was like a cloud. You couldn't see who was sitting next to you if you tried. And but the next guy I met was as tall as the other guy was short. And he had this big shock of white hair and a big toothy grin. He's very tall. And his belt buckle came right about to my eye level. And it said, bullshit. And he looks at me and he goes, honey. And all I can see is his teeth. And, you know, I'm looking up at him. All I can see is he says, you just keep coming back. It gets better and better and better. And I'm thinking, better than what? You know? So anyway, that very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not want to be there. I did not have a desire to quit drinking. But I sat there belligerently in the third row in the end seat. And then you guys did something remarkable, like you went around the room and you introduced yourself one at a time. You know, I'm so-and-so, I'm an alcoholic, I'm so-and-so, I'm an alcoholic. And I'm sitting there thinking, what a bunch of losers. You know, they're all identifying as alcoholic. They all seem to be happy about it. So they got to me, and I said, I'm Lily, I'm an alcoholic. Oh, my God, I'm an alcoholic. Right out loud, just like that. They all laughed, and it's like, holy shit. I'm with these guys now. I'm an alcoholic. Maybe I'm not really an alcoholic. I just said that because I wanted them to like me, you know. So then I excused myself. I got up from my seat. I walked to the front of the room where the coffee pot was, took the lid off, and smelled the coffee. Because I thought there had to be something in the coffee. There was no way these people could all be sitting there with big grins on their face, you know, happy, happy. There had to be something in the coffee, you know. Anyway, that night, this woman got up and she gave a talk, and what I found out later was it was a beginner's meeting, and they only talked about steps 1, 2, and 3. I didn't hear that. I didn't hear steps 1, 2, and 3. I just saw this woman up there, and a fella I just talked to a couple of minutes ago said what he heard when they spoke was, mwah, and that's what I heard. I didn't hear her say anything that made any sense to me, and I really wasn't paying attention to her anyway. What she did say, though, that saved this drunk's life was this. If you're too afraid, she held up a white chip, and she said, here at the Portland Group, we have a way to help you start a new way of life by offering you a white chip. And she held up this poker chip. And I thought to myself, you have got to be kidding. I already had a chip on my shoulder. But I'm thinking, you have got to be kidding me. This is in my head going on, you know. You don't drink and they pay you in poker chips? Whoa, you know. The next word she said were the words that saved this drunk's life. You see, I was brought up in a home with four brothers. I didn't come from an alcoholic home. I had a mom and a dad. My mom stayed home every day, took care of the kids, did the laundry, did all the things that moms do. You know, my dad went to work every day, came home every day at 4 o'clock. My mother would have gone to in the other room, she would put fresh lipstick on, comb her hair, and she would be standing at the sink doing the pre-dinner dishes, and my dad would walk in the door, and he would say, hi, honey, how was your day? And where are the kids? And she'd rattle off where we all were, you know. But I had those four brothers, and they used to antagonize me. So my household, when I was growing up, consisted of my mom, my dad, four brothers, me, and both of my grandmothers. And they were both sick, and my mother took care of them. So my brothers would tease me, and I would cry. I'd get all upset. I'd get mad. I'd throw a fit. And my Grammy said to me one day, she said, Lily, don't let them know that you're afraid of them, and they'll stop because they're not going to get the reaction they want to get. Well, you know, that became my life's mantra. I didn't know that until I came to be with you people. But that's the way I ran my life. If you scared me, I'd be in your face. I wasn't going to let you know I was afraid of you. I'm not afraid of anything. I can do whatever I want, whenever I want. If you don't like it, too bad. So this woman said, if you are too afraid to pick up a white chip, see me after the meeting and I'll give you one. And I thought, well, you people think I'm afraid of you? Well, I'm not. I was shaking in my boots. But I marched up there and I got that white chip. You know, and then after the meeting, people started saying things to you. You know, when you're a newcomer, keep coming back. I thought you said, I have a disease of perception. I thought you said, we need you. Because I certainly looked around the room and I thought they are a room full of losers. Apparently there's no organization except for the guy that put up the chairs and made the coffee. And they need somebody to come and straighten them out and help them out. And I'm going to stick around until I'm the exalted ruler of AA, and then I'm leaving. So they said things like, keep coming back. I heard things like, we need you. They said, this one did stick with me. And they said, if you feel like drinking, put this white chip in your mouth. If it melts, you can have one. And I'm just idiot enough to think that that really is going to work. So I'm thinking about a drink, and I put the white chip in my mouth, and I'm like, yeah, I don't want to drink. I don't want this chip either, but, you know, I got to go back next week because I got to help them. They need my help. I know they need my help. So anyway, and then the next thing, you know, the steps and the traditions were on the wall. And I'm not a dummy. I'm an alcoholic. I read those steps the first night. I decided which ones I was going to do and which ones I wasn't going to do and how I could reword them to meet my needs. You know, and I rewrote the serenity prayer, you know, so instead of God grant me the serenity, you know, to accept the things I cannot change, mine sounded like God give me the strength and the courage to change the things I can't accept. You know, I thought it sounded like the serenity prayer because, I mean, I have a disease of perception, you know. Anyway, the other thing they are very famous for saying here, if you're new here, I welcome you. If you felt like I felt, you know, and if you're in that back row at home, we call it denial aisle. But welcome anyway. You know, there isn't anything that a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous likes better than a newcomer. You know, you are the lifeblood of AA. When I first heard that, I thought, if I'm the lifeblood of AA, you guys are in big trouble, you know. And so anyway, they say things like, get a sponsor. Then the next time they see you, they go, did you get a sponsor? And then it seems like everybody in the room picks up the chant. Did you get a sponsor? Did you get a sponsor? Did you get a sponsor? So I finally decide I'm going to get a sponsor, and I pick this woman that I drank with because then I wouldn't have to do steps 4, 5, and 6. Because she drank with me. She knew what I was up to. Yeah, that didn't work. You know. And she did just like James. You know, I asked her to be my sponsor, and she said things like this. Are you willing to go to any lengths to stay sober? I don't think I was, but I knew that the right answer was probably yes. So I said, sure. Sure. I'll do whatever you say. But. So anyway, she says, great, call me tomorrow morning at 6. I called her at 5 minutes to 6. She didn't answer the phone. So I waited till 5 after 6. I called her. She didn't answer the phone. So I see her that night in a meeting, and I go, what the heck kind of a setup is that? You told me to call you at 6. I called you at 5 past, and you didn't answer the phone. She said, well, was it 6 o'clock? I'm like, seriously? She said, I told you to call at 6. And I didn't know that what she was trying to teach me was to be responsible. If you tell somebody you're going to do something at 6, you do it at 6. You know? So then, anyway, it starts out, and she says, we're going to do step 1. This is what it looked like for me. We admittedly, we were powerless over alcohol, but our lives had become unmanageable, right? Yeah, by now I figured I'm even hanging around for about 20 days by now, and I'm thinking, yeah, I know I'm an alcoholic. I really did. I knew I was an alcoholic before I got here, okay? But the problem was, is that the only person I asked for help was myself. You know, it sort of went like this, you know, tomorrow I won't drink. You know, and we make that's how alcoholics are. We make that promise, tomorrow we won't drink. Well, we don't say it out loud to anybody because what happens if you can't do it? You know, and in my case, that's what happened. You know, I promised myself, tomorrow I won't drink. But then tomorrow, I didn't like who I was. I'd wake up and I'd decide that I'm going to be Jimmy Buffett. And I would dress up like Jimmy Buffett and I would play Jimmy Buffett music all day, you know, because there's something wrong with me. I'm an alcoholic. I mean, I'm serious when I tell you I dressed up like somebody every day. When I wake up, I'd say, oh, I don't like me. I think I'll be Al Jolson, you know, or I think I'll be... I mean, it's not Halloween. I just dress up like these people and act like these people and pretend to be these people. And if you called me Lily, I wouldn't answer because today I'm Jimmy Buffett, you know. So the first thing she told me is you're going to stop dressing up every day, Lily. It's not Halloween, and you shouldn't come and introduce yourself places and say, well, I'm Jimmy Buffett today. They are not impressed with that. Oh, really? So I said to her, well, I get it. I get that I'm an alcoholic. Okay, so I admit I'm an alcoholic. I said, but my life is not unmanageable. Really? She said, let's just take a look at the last couple of weeks. You know, she knew some of, everybody in town knew the crap I was doing, right? She's like, are you the woman that was just sitting up on the back of a convertible at your daughter's party, and you were the chaperone, and you're in the back of the car, sitting up on the trunk of the car, waving to people as we drive down the street, like, hi, how you doing? We got a party going on over here. And I was like, yeah. And she goes, that's unmanageability. Oh. You know, and by the time I got here, I didn't have any carpet left on the floor. I had no lights, no heat, no running water, no groceries, no telephone. The bank was foreclosing on the house. I didn't think that was unmanageable. I mean, if you're an alcoholic like me, we'll figure that all out tomorrow. You know, in the meantime, let's drink. So she said to me, so you think your life is manageable? And I said, yeah. And she pointed out these things to me that, you know, made my life unmanageable. And I was like, oh, I've always managed those things before, you know, but, you know, and so we did steps 1, 2, and 3. And just like James said, you know, we did step 3 on our knees, holding hands, you know. And so then she said to me, now we're going to do step 4. Well, every time I went to a meeting, people are going, steps 4 and 5. Oh my God, they're so hard. Steps 4 and 5. 4 and 5, you know, and I was like, made a fearless and searching moral. Image. Well, I didn't have any morals, so I was no sinner, you know. But what I said to her one day is, you know, I'm sort of feeling like, I don't know, I'm probably 4 months sober, and I feel like I've hit a wall, and I'm not going anywhere. And everybody else around me I see that came in the same time I did seemed to be a little happier than I was, you know. And so I said to her, I feel like I hit a wall. And she goes, well, when you start working the 4th step, you might feel better. And I said, what am I supposed to do? And she said, well, go home and get out some paper. And I'm like, okay, I got that. Get the paper. Put the paper down. And then she said, write down the things that you did that you think were hateful. And then write down the people that you hate. Make a list. And why do you hate them? Or why are you mad at them? And I said, I'm not mad at anybody. I am not mad at anybody. She said, well, then just write down the things that you hate. So, and again, if you heard me the other night, I really believed in my heart of hearts that there was a school for sponsors where you went, where you, if you were a sponsor, you could apply to be a sponsor in AA, and they would send you to the school where you'd learn idiot stuff to say to the newcomer. And if you weren't a sponsor, and that would be the thing I would ask you when I first met you, are you a sponsor? And if you said no, then I knew stay away from you because you're a spy. Because you see, that's how it works here. You know, they have the sponsors that went to school that learned the stuff to tell you what to do, and then they have the spy group. And they're the ones that know what the sponsor told you to do, and they're going to see if you did it, and if you didn't, they're going to report you. And then you're going to get kicked out of AA. I mean, there's nothing wrong with me when I got here. It's just an alcoholic, you know? So, anyway, and she used to do this to me, right? And then when I'd get home, my phone would be ringing. We didn't have cell phones back then. We had headphones on the wall. My phone would be ringing, and it would be her. And she'd say, and by the way, before you start, say this little prayer. Okay, and this is what the prayer was. It's called the 4th step prayer. God, please help me show those I resent the same tolerance, pity, and patience that I would cheerfully grant a sick friend. Help me to see that this is a sick man. Father, please show me how I can be helpful to him to save me from being angry. Lord, help me to avoid retaliation or argument. I know I can't be helpful to all people, but at least show me how to be kindly and tolerant and view each and every one. Thy will be done. I thought that was ridiculous. And then she said, I want you to get a pen, and I just want you to sit there, and I want you to draw circles on the top of the page. And I'm thinking I'm back in parochial school, you know, learning Palmer penmanship. It's made circles. You know, and I was like, why am I making circles? She said, you're just waiting for God. You're waiting for God to enter your life, you know. And the next thing I knew, I'm making this list, right? But I'm getting to the end of the list, and I don't feel very good about me. You know, I write a page, And I would start feeling bad, like the things that I had done to people. Then I went to this meeting on a Monday morning, and there was an old timer there. He used to always say, "I'm delighted to be here." And that morning, they happened to be talking about the fourth step, and I said, "Well, I'm really struggling with that fourth step." I said, "You know, I get down to the end of the page, and I've written down all this stuff that a miserable person I am, and it just makes me sick to my stomach to look at that stuff." And he said, "Oh, you're doing the wrong kind of inventory." And I went, "What?" He said, "Well, you know, when they do inventory in a store, they don't just inventory the bad products, they inventory the good products too. So when you begin every single one of these pages that you're working on, the first line should be, 'Why do you hate Lily?' And say something good about yourself." You know, that was harder to do than to write down all the crap that we do. And he said, "When you get to the bottom of the page, end it with something else good that you can say about yourself." I struggled with trying to find something good about me, because now I'm looking at all this stuff and all this hate and all this, how obnoxious I was and how I neglected my children. You know, when my children needed me the most, I was there the least, because the disease of alcoholism had me by the tail, you know, and those kids were teenagers and they were home and they needed a mom. But I couldn't be mom because I had to be on the bar stool talking with the boys, you know, and telling them that my life was grand and my life was a shambles. But if you heard me, you'd think I lived in the Taj Mahal, you know. So I started writing this fourth step inventory, and I got it all done. And I always was sort of hateful to this sponsor, because I would say to her, "What's next?" It's a real nice attitude, you know, "What's next?" She'd say, "Well, next we're going to do step 5. "Well, what's step 5? "Well, you admit to God, to yourself and another human being, the exact nature of your wrongs." "Yeah, well, I'll save that for the priest. I ain't telling you." You know. Hey, I was brought up Catholic. You know, we went to confession every single week. We lied to the priest. "Oh, I swore 7 times. You know, I stole my brother's penny. You know, blah, blah, blah." You never told him the real stuff. Are you kidding me? You know, if you told them the real stuff, you'd have to be at the front saying the whole rosary, and then, you know, everybody'd know you were really were a sinner. And so you just made up lies and told the priest that. But I told her I was gonna do my fifth step with the priest, and she said, "Yeah, you can do that with the priest right after you talk to me." Then I'm dreading it, because I'm thinking, I've got to tell, I've done some things this woman doesn't know about. You know, and I was ashamed when I wrote that stuff down. But we sat down face to face, and then we said the fifth step prayer. She asked God to come be with us as I shared my story. And she kept interrupting me. You know, she'd go, "Oh, I remember a time when," and then she'd tell me something she did that was even worse than what I did, and I'm thinking, whoa. You know? So it really was about sharing with another human being what you considered to be the exact nature of your wrongs. You know? And by the time I got done, I thought, I'm a pretty lousy person. You know, I'm a lousy mother. I'm a lousy friend. I'm a lousy employee. You know? I just don't do anything right. It seems like I think I do everything right. But when I really look at it in black and white, I've made some mistakes along the way. So anyway, we sat down and we did this step 5, and I, you know, I wish I could tell you that. I mean, in the big book it describes, you know, how you feel like this weight is lifted off your shoulders. I didn't feel that way. I sort of felt like, man, I really am a bad person. I'm a bad, bad person. You know, I look good on the outside, but on the inside, my soul is black, you know. And so, you know, you take an hour or two afterwards and you sort of reflect on how you feel. And I didn't feel very good about me. I called my sponsor up and I said, "You know, I really don't feel any sense of relief over having done this fourth and fifth step." I said, "What I feel is all the things that I blocked with alcohol have come to the forefront And now I'm the loser. And she was like, no, Lily, you're the winner. You're the winner. Because now you have to practice letting that stuff go. You know? The first person that you should be trying to forgive is yourself. And when you can do that, then you can be of service to God and those amongst you. Right? I just struggled with it. I mean, I had said everything that I wanted to say, and including, she said to me, you know, what's the thing you're going to take to the grave with you? You know, and we've all got that story in our history, you know, drunk or sober, we've got that one thing that we're not going to tell anybody about, you know? And I wasn't going to tell her. I was so ashamed. I wasn't going to tell her. And she just looked at me and she says, has it got anything to do with sex? Like, you're not supposed to talk about that. I already read that in the big book. We don't talk about that. You know, we talk about that with God. And she says, yeah, well, let's just you and I talk about it. Let me tell you what I did that I think was so horrible, and you tell me if you can relate. And that's how it went. She knew that that was the one thing I was afraid of, you know, that one secret we're going to keep, you know. Then you let go of that one secret. That's when you get the freedom, you know. You're not as bad as you think. If you're sitting in this room and you're thinking that you're the worst person that ever joined AA and that you've got these secrets that you can't tell anybody, you're only set free when you let go of them, you know. So we did that step, and we kept coming back to that step because I kept remembering things after the fact. So people go, well, how many times have you done a fourth step? Well, I have only done one fourth step continuously for the entire time that I have been in AA. You know, because things, you know, more will be revealed. Well, more will be revealed, you know, trust me. And step six, you know, became willing to have God remove all these defects of character. I argued with her. Some of these things I didn't think were defects of character. I sort of thought they were good things I should hang on to, you know. And she said, well, you have a great sense of humor. I said, yeah. I said, you know, I'm really worried about that. Do I have to get rid of my sense of humor to be in AA? And she said, no, God will use your sense of humor in a way that will make it acceptable to people and they'll be able to relate to you, you know. Because I've always been sort of the wise guy in the crowd, you know. My ideas were good. They were always good, you know. Always had the best ideas. You heard about some of my best ideas the other day. I forgot to tell you one of my best ideas, though. I had a job one time. I worked in the MVETS, and I used to make up drinks. I only ever had one blackout in my life that I recall. I'm sure that there are a lot of people around that realize some of that I have no idea. But this one I remember because this is how I woke up. I had invented this drink called Bat Juice. You know, and Batman was popular. That's just a da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, so I invented this drink, Bat Juice. And what it was, I know it's probably going to make some of you ill, but you take a shot glass and you fill it with root beer schnapps. And you put it inside another glass. And then you pour beer down the side of the glass until it hits the root beer and it makes like a volcanic eruption. And then you pick it up and suck it down, right? Well, we were in a Batman kind of mood, and I don't know how many we drank, but the next thing I knew, I came to and I was hanging by my heels from the rafters of the bar being a bat. That's not the worst of it. I talked my daughter into joining me. So now you got mom and daughter hanging from the rafters by their heels pretending to be bats, you know? That's the kind of plans I come up with. You know, those are the kinds of plans that I come up with. I'm a real alcoholic. I'm a really true alcoholic. things have come up. You know, it's one of the things that came up for me, I was brought up Catholic. I don't have an issue with that. I'm a Catholic in good standing today. It still works for me. You know, I still pray the rosary. That's my personal choice. I don't know what your personal choice is, but for me that works. You know, I have a group that I belong to every Tuesday night. We all have dinner together and then we pray for all the other people that have asked for prayers. And I always have a special intention, and my special intention, you never say your special intention out loud. You just say I have a special intention. And this is my special intention. I pray for all the sick and suffering people that are still out there that haven't found their way to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and one of those people is my son. You know, I'm not sure what this has to do with the sixth step, except that I'm feeling moved to share this story with you, and that is that I gave birth to four children, and I've buried two. One is an infant with SIDS, and one 33-year-old policeman that was well-regarded in his community. And, you know, I was sober when that son died. And I had just seen him 6 weeks before that. I had been asked to speak at a convention in New Jersey. And he came to that convention from Washington, D.C., and we had a wonderful weekend, you know. We did all this crazy stuff. We raced to the top of the Cape May Lighthouse, and he heard me speak, and I had him out on the beach, and we're picking up these rocks on the beach. And he was like, "Mom, what are we picking these rocks up for?" And I said, "Well, your crazy mother leads women's retreats now. I do day retreats at home for women that can't go for a whole weekend, for women that have children that can maybe only come for about 7 hours for a day, you know." And I said, "I don't know what I'm going to do with these white rocks, but I know that I need them." So we picked up all these rocks, you know. And he met all my friends in AA, and he heard me speak for the first time. And I got to make my amends with that young man that weekend, you know. And 6 weeks later, I got the phone call that no mother wants to get. My son was gone. He died from a disease called sepsis. He was working undercover at Metropolitan Police Department. He had recently had a tattoo to make him a little more believable as a thug. And they suspect that he may have gotten blood poisoning from that. I don't know if that's true. I just know that I'm a member of AA in good standing. And what that means is I have a home group. I have a sponsor. I sponsor women. You know, I'm involved at the district level at home. I'm involved at the area level at home, and that's my choice and my path. You know, my path is to give back what was given to me. So I get this phone call. And the first thing I did was get on my knees and pray to the Blessed Mother. And then at 5 o'clock in the morning, I called a friend in AA, and I could barely get the words out of my throat that my son had passed away. And the next thing I knew, my house was full of people from Alcoholics Anonymous. They were there. They supported me. They showed me by their own example how to stand tall. You know, 70 policemen came from Washington, D.C. to be at my son's funeral. There were cops from all over the country that came for his funeral. We're at the wake. And he had a police honor guard. And one of his police partner came up to me and said, "Lily, I've never seen anybody with this many friends." He said, "I've been to a lot of funerals for a lot of cops, but I've never seen anybody with this many friends." And I said, "I know." And they couldn't all come. And he said, "Excuse me." And I said, "Well, they wanted to, but when they got here and saw all these cruisers, they kept on going." And you know, I was a girl that started drinking at the top of the East and ended up at a place called the Dump on the Hump. And those boys at the Dump on the Hump had some warrants that were still outstanding. So, but I'm here to tell you this morning that as heartbreaking as it is to bury children, it's my opinion that it's harder to watch somebody you love dying from this disease. And that's what I have going on in my life. My son is dying from the disease of alcoholism and drug addiction. And when you see him, you don't even recognize him, you know, and he's at the end. He's at the very end, and I can see it. I can see it in the way he holds himself. He's homeless. You know, he's homeless. And I'll tell you a little story that made me laugh, and as crazy as it sounds, this kid is dying, but I took him out to a meeting one time. He wanted to go to a meeting, so I take him to this meeting. And after the meeting, I say to him, how about if I take you out and get you something to eat? See, I'm also a member of Al-Anon, and what I've learned is to stop giving him things and fixing up all his problems. Let him live his life the way that he chooses to live it, and you just pray for God for acceptance. And so I say to him, why don't you let me take you out and get you something to eat? Because I'm thinking, you know, a hot meal. You know, he's homeless. It's cold as hell. You know, it's freezing. And he's sleeping underneath a trailer on pallets. And he says to me, no, I think I'll just go home and tidy up my place. You know that part in the book that says we pause and reflect? Yeah, I haven't conquered that yet. I just looked at him and I was like, what the hell are you talking about? Tidy up your place? You're homeless. What do you, rearrange trash bags? I mean, would you move the pallets around? And he's like, I just want to tidy up my place. Can you just let it go with that? 2 days later, I get a call. He's being evicted. How do you get evicted? You're homeless. He said, well, they're moving the trailer, and I got to get my stuff out of here. You know, I haven't talked to that young man since. He goes to prison. When he gets to prison, he does really good. He gets sober, and he comes out, and he stays sober for a period of time. And then he goes back to the old ways again, you know. So I'm deeply grateful for the people that carry the message inside the walls, because that's where he appears to be able to hear it. I haven't spoken to him or seen him for over a year. And the last time that I spoke to him, I said to him these two things. These are the two things that I can do for you. I can pray for you, and I can love you with all my heart, as I have done since the day you were born. Other than that, I got nothing else. It's hard to live those words, you know. That's the hardest thing I've ever been asked to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, is watching this kid die from this disease and knowing that all of you came from wherever your bottom was and that you found the light here in AA, that you found love here in AA. You know, and my prayer used to be in the morning, I'd get up and I'd do the third step prayer, and then I'd have another little prayer, and I always called it God's laundry list. You know, God, please help Tommy be okay. God, please make my day better. God, please let me win the lottery. You know, God, you know, do this, do this, do this. You know, my prayer has changed over the years. My prayers today sort of sound like this. This is what I said when I got up this morning. I got on my knees by my bed and I said, God, I turn myself over to you to do with me as you will. Please let me accept your will for me and for those about me. And let me know what that is. And sometime during the day, you may have to bonk me on the head because I know I'm going to try to take my will back and fix it. You know? And, you know, that's worked for me to be able to let go of that kid. I don't know if I'll get that phone call about him or if it'll be a knock on the door. But I know that if it does happen, that everybody in AA will surround me like they did before. You know, there was this one man. I dreaded going to meetings after I lost my son because everybody comes up to you and they say things that are really sweet and nice, you know, like, I'm so sorry for your loss. And inside my head, I'm an alcoholic and I'm thinking, if I have to say thank you to one more person for feeling sorry that my son died, I swear I'm going to lose it. I'm just going to lose it, you know. So I'm dreading going to this meeting, and the women that I hang out with keep saying to me over and over and over again, Lily, you're such a power of example. And in my head, I'm going, I don't want to be an effing power of example, okay? This sucks. You know, this sucks. Stop saying that. I don't want to be a power of example, you know? But I go to this meeting one night, And there's this guy there. His name's Big John. He wasn't very big. His hands were really gnarled with arthritis. I mean, his hands were completely deformed. I know what that felt like, you know, and it must be painful to have hands like that, because my hands don't look like that, but I have arthritis in my hands, and it can be very painful. And he always had the stub of a cigar in his mouth. He was always chewing on this cigar, you know. They called him Big John. And Big John sees me come into the meeting room, and he goes, "You, in the kitchen." "Yes, sir," you know. I go into the kitchen, and he goes like this with his gnarled old hand. "The guy upstairs has got your son. You don't have to worry anymore. Your job," and then he goes like this, "your job is to let all of us help you until you can stand on your own 2 feet again. You got that?" "Yes, sir." You know? And so the thing of it is that, you know, people like, you know, think they put you on like a pedestal because you've had this horrendous loss. And they think you're somebody special. And I'm not. I'm an alcoholic. Found their way to the halls of Alcoholics Anonymous November 8th, 1989, when I was told by my doctor that the heart attack that I suffered was a direct result of abuse and alcohol, that I had cirrhosis of the liver, stage 3. He didn't know if my liver would recover. And maybe I should find my way to the halls of AA. And I did not come here with a desire to quit drinking. I came here with a desire for people to get off my back about my drinking. I stuck around long enough to hear some of you say, the way that you'll get better, the way that this program works, is by taking the steps. Okay, because I'm thinking working the steps. But if you're an alcoholic like I am, you know, we're good at taking. So take the steps. Take the steps, you know, and I want to end with this. You know, steps 1, 2, and 3 is when we give up, and steps 4, 5, and 6 is when we look up. 7, 8, and 9 is when we fix up, and 10, 11, and 12 is when we keep it up. Thank you very much for letting me share.